Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work. And today, you might already know, but we are recording remotely, so because we're social distancing. I'm recording from my bedroom, so I'll warn you right now that, again, you may hear my cat Chicken screaming in the background. Audio is likely going to sound a little different from our studios, but everything else is the same. Beside my cat, there's also a little birdie outside that you might hear, which usually doesn't cause me any problems, but now it sounds a little loud. And today, I'm very excited to have writer, producer, actor, pretty much everything slash Felicia Day here with me as my guest. Hi, Felicia.
Hello. How are you? Thank you so much for having me, April.
Yes. And, you know, Felicia's got construction going on in her house. So I'm really excited
I'm so
to
sorry.
Hear some of that
This is the worst time, ever to have, because I have a beautiful studio, but I had it torn down because I'm building on top of the studio. Oh my gosh. And of course, they were totally silent before we started recording.
I'm excited because it's like a Cribs episode with audio. We're just like, here, welcome to my home. This is what we're doing.
Yeah, welcome to it. Yeah. So, I mean, my plan is to build a soundproof, like a studio where I can record and stream from a little bit better. But also I have like a guest room on top of so my dad can come visit. So it's just the worst timing ever.
She's a family woman. For those of you who aren't as familiar with Felicia's work, where have you been? But also, please let me give an introduction. Felicia is an Alabama native who's kind of a genius who graduated with a degree in music and mathematics from UT Austin by the time that she was 19. 19?
Yeah, I graduated at 19, but I went at 16.
Jesus.
Well,
Christ.
I was 20. I guess I turned 20 right after that. So it's really not that exciting.
Sure. All right. Well, that was fortunate that she graduated early because she's had a busy career ahead of her in film and television. Some of her first roles happened to be in cult classics, including Bring It On Again, Undeclared, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But ever industrious, she created and starred in a web series of her own called The Guild, which ran from 2007 to 2013, exploring gaming subcultures before it was cool. And from that foray, she developed Geek and Sundry, a YouTube channel and production company for all things geek that garnered 2 million subscribers and was ultimately sold to Legendary Entertainment in 2014. Somewhere in there, Felicia found time to star in Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog and appeared in shows including Dollhouse, Red, Eureka, Supernatural, and The Magicians, among so many other series and podcasts. In 2017, she began starring as Kinga Forrester, a cheerful villain who forces some robots and a lowly worker named Jonah to watch terrible movies in the reboot of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Now she's starring in a new Blumhouse Into the Dark film, Alejandro Brugues's Puka Lives, about a company trying to make their own Momo Slenderman-esque scary internet sensation that becomes quickly too real and out of control. So that's Felicia in a nutshell. But Felicia, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Gremlins. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Well, I think this was one of the first films besides E.T. that I remember. So I guess my early childhood was filled with animatronic puppets.
Yeah.
I think my mom, she definitely exposed me to things a little bit above my, because I was probably like 5 or 6 when I watched this movie. So I think it's my first trauma, but also my first love of movies, because it was just, I loved Gizmo so much. When Gizmo got in that little pink car, it was like the most beautiful moment of my childhood.
We'll talk about that later, but that was a last minute decision to put Gizmo in that car.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. It was a stroke of genius, because Gizmo kind of just rides around in a backpack, kind of like a child, you know, like as children, we are very unempowered, you know, as a kids, we just kind of go wherever our adult comes. And then he had that moment at the end of like, I'm doing it.
For those of you who haven't seen Gremlins, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. This is a movie from 1984. Come on. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you'd like to pause and watch Gremlins first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Gremlins. Written by Chris Columbus and directed by Joe Dante for release in 1984, Gremlins stars Zach Galligan as Billy Peltzer, a nice young guy who works in a bank, loves his dog, pines for his coworker Kate.
Because, I mean, I was just wondering, if you're not doing anything this Thursday night, maybe you'd like to go out on a date with me?
I'd love to.
Oh, yeah? Well, that's great.
And tolerates his naive inventor dad, Randall. One day, Randall moseys into a Chinatown antique store looking for a Christmas present for Billy. The owner, Mr. Wing, refuses to sell a cuddly little creature called Mogwai to Randall, but Mr. Wing's grandson sells it to him and gives him three rules.
Keep him out of the light. He hates bright light, especially sunlight. It'll kill him. And keep him away from water. Don't get him wet. But the most important rule, the rule you can never forget, no matter how much he cries, no matter how much he begs, never, never feed him after midnight.
Kind of confusing rules as you grow up. You're like, what? Billy gets the pet and names him Gizmo. His buddy Pete comes over and almost immediately spills water on Gizmo, and five new Mogwais bubble and spring from his back, including one mischievous one called Stripe with a mohawk.
You know, it's funny. The new ones aren't like Gizmo. The one with the stripe seems to be the leader.
I loved Stripe.
Stripe is the best.
Yeah, so good. Billy lets his old science teacher experiment on a Mogwai, and back at home, Stripe tricks Billy into feeding them after midnight by changing his clocks. The Mogwais form cocoons and hatch anew as ugly, lizard-like gremlins. They torture Gizmo, try to kill Billy's mom, and meanwhile, one kills the science teacher. Then all the gremlins get killed but Spike, who hops into a pool and creates a bunch more gremlins. These gremlins wreak havoc on the town, killing a bunch of people, including Miss Daigle, a surly lady who threatened to kill Billy's dog. The police don't believe Billy.
Gremlins, huh? Little monsters.
Right.
Hundreds of them.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe thousands.
Wow.
Look, I know it sounds crazy. I know it does. But in a matter of hours, this town is going to be turned into a major disaster area. Now you have got to warn people.
You think this kid is drunk, Brent?
No, you are, huh?
Gremlins take over the town. A bunch end up at the bar where Kate works at night. They get drunk and rowdy, but she escapes by using the flash of a camera. Billy, Kate, and Gizmo find all the gremlins in the movie theater and blow it up. But Stripe has escaped. They chase him into a department store, and Gizmo saves the day by exposing Stripe to sunlight. Mr. Wing retrieves Gizmo, but Gizmo and Billy hope to be reunited someday when Billy's ready.
Bye, Billy.
Perhaps someday you may be ready. Until then, Mogwai will be waiting.
Okay, so that is Gremlins, you know, as much as I can explain it. But I, you know, I wanted to go back into the fact that this is, this actually was Joe Dante's big hit. It was not even The Howling, you know, and The Howling is an amazing movie. But Joe Dante said, quote, "I was down to my last few bucks before I got the Gremlins job. I directed The Howling, which had done well, but the company had gone out of business before they could even pay me. When Steven Spielberg's script arrived, I was convinced he'd sent it to the wrong address." So I like thinking that the fact that, like, Joe Dante, who we consider a legend, was like down to his last few dollars, and Gremlins was the only thing that was going to get him, you know, like maybe paying his grocery bills for the month.
There are a lot of good stories like that. I think Hilary Swank is my favorite, where she lost her health insurance but won an Oscar, you know, for the boxing movie. So
yes,
yeah, but you know, it was interesting because I watched this movie with on Amazon Prime for free, you know, because I have Prime. And it has all these little factoids on the side, which actually are really fun.
Yeah.
And one of the little factoids was that Steven Spielberg considered Tim Burton for this, but the fact that he had never done a feature length thing ruled him out. And I kept watching the movie thinking, oh, wow, how would this be different with Tim Burton? It would be creepier.
Yeah. But there's also certain impulses that I think that Joe Dante and Tim Burton share, which is, you know, sometimes like this kind of exploration of an older kind of nuclear family unit and kind of deconstructing that, you know, like taking the sheen off of it.
Yeah. You know, when I was watching this movie, I was like, I'm always struck by the difference between 80, just the way that they're shot is so much slower. The first 17 minutes, I'm just like, wow, this is really taking a long time, and then it really picks up. But the pace of storytelling is different. There's so many more wide shots. Like, really, the lack of close-ups is almost jarring when you watch an 80s movie.
Yeah,
because everything's done in mediums and wides, and it's so odd because I'm watching it and I'm thinking, God, we should really be in a close-up on her face when she turns to him, but we don't even see but half her face. And I'm like, is this fine? Why don't we shoot movies like this? But at the same time, also, the characters are so strangely broad. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very almost like comic, like the old woman is just like a farce character. She's not a real character. And then somehow this kid the lead kid is over 18 because he works at a bank, right?
Yes. So, yes.
But then he has like a 12-year-old best friend.
Yes. Who's,
why? What is going on there?
Okay. So
it's very odd.
A lot of that has to do with the fact that the script was rewritten. Chris Columbus had submitted one where Zach Galligan's character was supposed to be 13. And so he had an 11-year-old friend. So it was already a little bit strange where he was like a little bit of an outcast and had like a younger friend. But yeah. It is hilarious to me that they kept the 11-year-old friend.
Corey Feldman just coming in for no reason. I was like, is he here? His brother? No, he's just a friend. What is going on here?
Joe Dante said, quote, when Steven saw the script, he was noodling around with the idea of starting his own company. He wanted to get off the ground with a low-budget horror movie, which is obviously why he chose me. Steven had seen Piranha and he had seen The Howling. Chris wrote the script as a spec. It was sent around town as a writing sample. The lead kid was younger in the original script, about 13. Later, his age was bumped up, though he retained almost all his childlike aspects, and his best friend was still 11. Chris stayed on for the whole picture when we did reshoots on a little stage on La Brea. He was working on Goonies at the time. Steven and he would sit in the corner and he would write. I wouldn't call Amblin at any time a factory because they didn't make enough movies for that, but they did have a lot of things going on and often going on simultaneously. So there's this kind of large pervasive thought that we get, you know, something that you brought up earlier, the 80s kind of aesthetic, where there's almost a child likeness to all of the characters, no matter their age. So it's almost like they are timeless. They don't exist in this space. They don't exist in reality, but they're, they're kind of like tugging at your heartstrings no matter what. Cause you know.
Yeah. It's almost like, especially even the way that they directed. I mean, like, I don't really, you know, I don't know a lot about the lead actor other than the Gremlins, but
yeah,
he's really kind of a glass of water. Like there's really, they almost pick close-ups of his face that he's not reacting. It's just so weird. The fact that he's not emoting, he's like staring at something that there should be a reaction there. And it's just kind of like, okay. So it's very odd. And those are all directorial choices. I'm sure the actor did not react.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's very much just like almost a passive participant and this childlike sort of sensibility also, right? Just like
Yes. The
fact that the secondary characters are so broad. And I mean, even a modern sitcom would be like, oh, that old lady person who wants to put his dog to sleep. That's just like not even real.
Oh,
but it
yeah.
is. But it's so odd because that that's how the films were. All the characters are completely unbelievable in their broadness of, but then they're murdering people. So it's just this weird dichotomy of tone. You're just like, I don't know where to be right now.
Yeah. You had mentioned stuff too about these kind of quirky characters. I want to get a little bit further into that because Joe Dante said, quote, we tried to have eccentric, likable characters like the father, an inventor. When we were casting the father, we had a lot of different actors come in. One of them was Pat Hingle. He gave a reading that was so heartrending, wrenching, and moving that I had to say to this great actor, I can't give you the part. This is too real. He would have been brilliant in the movie, but it would have been a James Agee movie. Hoyt Axton was perfect because he had all this folksy charm and he was good with an ad lib. So casting is so important. Just to find the right people for the parts, it's everything. That's the movie. That's what people are going to look at. They're not going to look at you. They're looking at the cast. And I think that that's a really interesting element of this film where, they could have had more serious actors, but they had to find the exact right tone of someone who connected with that material. And
yeah, I think that kind of like tone, I mean, I totally agree with you. And in watching Gremlins, you're just like, I don't know who could have made this, but this is the only person who could have made it. And they made it on every level of taste. It's consistent. And I think that, you know, I'm like, nobody would make this. Nobody would do this now. But at the same time, it's brilliant and it's iconic and people are going to watch it for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that there's a vision there. It is a complete whole. I like, for me, everything I do is done sensorily. You know, I have a feeling about whether something is good or bad. I don't really use technical cerebral. This is my outline and these are the act breaks and this is where the reversal happened. I can't think like that. I have to just kind of feel my way through things and see if, oh, this feels right. Oh, this feels like something that is exciting to me and it's new. And so when I see something like Gremlins or you have, a creator like Joe Dante, who he has a specific point of view. It's not for everybody, but he creates something that is of his vision. That's really compelling. And that's where things pop. Not when you do something by committee where it's clear that, okay, we cast this person because they have a deal here, or we shot here because, you know, we had that's a little bit more convenient for us. And, you know, these are the actors, this is the kind of cinematographer we got that doesn't really mesh with the style. I think that's filmmaking. You want to create sort of this, what are those things called when you put them all in a piece of glass, and it's self-contained? What is that called?
Like a
biodome
a
or something?
Yeah,
terrarium. Yeah. So it's a completely enclosed terrarium. That's what every piece of art that's great is.
And I think we were talking about this before, but yeah, you having your own network allows you to create that terrarium when you were doing it, you know, like that seemed, you know, like you only got to say yes to yourself or no to yourself.
No, absolutely. And, you know, that was the trade-off of just only having hundreds of thousands of dollars versus a million or above, right? Yeah. But at the same time, like creating the brand of Geek & Sundry, which was my company, was a sensibility that I wanted every video that we did to be of that sensibility. So if you watched it, you'd know, oh, this is a Geek & Sundry thing. And I think we did that for a while, that very successfully, in that the sensibility was, it was very colorful, it was upbeat, it was quirky and celebrating weirdness, but in a fun, happy way.
Yeah.
And it didn't try to be cool because I literally can't be cool. You know, I just can't. I just pitched another show. The last show I pitched, which got pretty close to getting sold, people were like, oh, well, you know, this isn't going to sell. We love this show. This is what I hear all the time. We love this show. We don't know where to sell it because it's not Disney enough for Disney, and it's not edgy enough for for cable. So can you add some sex and drug use? And I'm like, that's not my style, man. I don't want teenagers having sex and doing drugs. Can we talk about body image? No, nobody wants that, you know? So I'm like, I don't know what to do for you except just do my own stuff.
Just make it sexy. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get a little bit further into some process stuff from both Spielberg and from Joe Dante. We'll be right back.
One, two, one, two, three. Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
We're both doctors and...
Nope, just me.
Okay, well, Sydney's a doctor and I'm a medical enthusiast, and we create Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Every week, I dig through the annals of medical history to bring you the wildest, grossest, sometimes dumbest tales of ways we've tried to treat people throughout history.
And lately, we do a lot of modern fake medicine, because everything's a disaster, but it's slightly less of a disaster every Friday right here on MaximumFun.org as we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. And remember,
don't drill a hole in your head.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf. I'm joined today with Felicia Day from her studio that she's remodeling, and we're talking about Gremlins. So something that I was really, really loving, there's a quote that Joe Dante thought about realism, and because people kept asking him, you know, like, what about realism? And there's one point where in an interview, someone was like, it's winter out, but you can't see the condensation of their breath. And he was like, ugh. And his response was, quote, we shot it in the middle of summer, so there was no way we were going to be able to fake something like seeing that character's breath condense in cold air. Today, if you wanted to spend the money on CGI, you could actually make it look real, but that's still pretty expensive. In Gremlins, the unreality is actually what counts. I was adamant that it not look realistic, that it look like what we remembered from old movies. It's what the Zuckers did on Airplane. They tried to make the movie look old-fashioned by the clothing and the props. The photographers in Airplane had old flashbulb cameras, too. I intended Gremlins to be the kind of timeless. You couldn't just take this rubber thing out in the city streets and hit it with this light. This movie had to be stylized, end quote. I thought that was just a really smart way of approaching this, because you do have to make it believable that these things exist in this world. But how do you make it believable? By making it like a stylized realism that exist, but
I mean, 100%. And I don't know. You could tell with the way the camera moved very slowly and not very fast, you know, like there was aesthetic, and also just shooting from, you know, in wides and mediums. It's not like movies in the 80s never had close-ups. So it was sort of like that 1940s, 30s aesthetic where you can't move the camera up close in. You can't do a lot of, it was more of a stage presentation. And there's almost an impression you get when you're watching it of I'm watching sort of a holiday play in a sense.
Yeah.
Until you get to the murder sections. So all the dialogue up front, the first 17 minutes, feels slow because it is shot in a way that's very like It's a Wonderful Life or whatever. That's actually really interesting because I did notice that.
One of the things that Joe Dante has brought up recently, though, is the fact that, apparently, this was right before Disney. Who took over the big head honcho for Disney? I can't remember who it was, but he was the one who
Michael Eisner? Eisner?
Yeah. Yeah. When he came in and kind of cleaned up house and like really kind of corporatized a lot of things. So Joe Dante was able to get the rights to show that clip to It's a Wonderful Life and these other movies because it was right before Eisner had come in and essentially kind of like said, no, we're not doing this. You don't get to lend it out. And so he said, quote, the people who hold the rights to the clips make it expensive and difficult because they really don't want to be bothered. So that's one thing. And also Snow White. And Snow White and Disney may be a special case, but in general, movie literacy has plummeted. When you and I were growing up, our casual acquaintances with old movies and movie stars in the world of the 30s and 40s could be renewed all the time. Everything was there to be sampled. Every time you turned on the TV, there was an old movie. And so, end quote. I think that that's a really interesting thing too, where you can talk to people, like young people who are into something like Stranger Things. They'll be like, yeah, but they might not actually know where the references are coming from. You know, they might not have the literacy
absolutely.
To know that.
I mean, you know, I've been really into Greek mythology and other kind of ancient kind of like Bronze Age history, which has really fascinated me. And, you know, the roots of a lot of our culture and a lot of our storytelling are way back there. But we only know seven iterations, you know, seven. So we're kind of eating, you know, we're looking at the sort of the sediment piled on top of each other and we kind of lose the roots of it. Right. So.
Yeah.
And you know, the funny thing is, I was homeschooled and so I didn't really have contemporaries or any kids around me ever. So it wasn't as if when I went to school, everyone was like, did you see the latest, you know, Disney Channel show? I never watched any of that. I watched, you know, 1930s detective movies. I was in love with Humphrey Bogart and Cary Grant. And I wanted to be a dame in sort of a screwball comedy.
Yeah.
So that was really my aesthetic. And, you know, that was a sort of like more childlike attitude a lot of the times in those movies, especially after the code went through, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's where a lot of my comedy and my sensibility comes from. And I think a lot of these filmmakers in the 70s, when they got the shot to do like a low budget kind of out of the studio system movie, it was kind of the same equivalent of any, you know, period where the door gets opened a little bit and some weird stuff can happen. Like right now in the next couple of years, we're going to see a lot of live streaming and live things that are out of the box because the door's open right now. I guarantee you in 3 years, most live content will be owned by the corporations, just like web series happened, just like podcasting has happened. But there's a window where some stuff can get through and some people can find careers doing the stuff that is a little off. And hopefully they can keep doing that instead of getting co-opted into the system.
Well, I also want to bring up the fact that when you're doing Mystery Science Theater, that character that you've developed, that kind of character is certainly a throwback to a kind of 30s, 40s, you know, kind of fast talking, like, you know, like just a fun dame kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and absolutely. You know, and that's Joel's sensibility too, like developing that character, you know, that was kind of, you know, we just aesthetically, he's a very aesthetic person, you know, visual. Mm-hmm. So her whole get up and the way her hair is and stuff like that, it was really easy to kind of have that rapport, especially with Patton Oswalt, who is kind of an actor who could have lived during any era, you know, he has a sort of universal quality to him that he could be from the 30s, he could be from the 80s. And not a lot of people can do that, right? Like, not a lot of people are totally contemporary, you know. You don't buy them in a period setting at all. And it's just the aesthetics of them. And some people are more universal. And I've been in a lot of period pieces because my face does look like something a little bit old fashioned in a way, which
you
I love.
Time travel. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Maybe 100 years. I wouldn't want to time travel because women really had it crappy pretty much every other year. So, but I think, and obviously, like, especially for Mystery Science Theater, like, a lot of the references are older references. Like, some of the times I was watching old ones to prepare for writing for the show. And like, I loved the show so much as a kid because it was adults, but they had a kid-like sensibility, right?
Yeah.
And half the references I didn't even get now, and I certainly didn't get them when I was a kid. But the fact that there was that sort of sense of fun and the robots, and he would read letters from kids at the end, even though he was an adult, it really makes you feel like, you know, you're just another person. You can be an adult. It sort of suspends the whole age thing. And I guess why when you're watching Gremlins, it's not that creepy that the 20-year-old kid has an 11-year-old friend.
Yeah.
But then when you're just back up, you're like, why is Corey Feldman there?
No, I mean, I think that like this Gremlins and that show and that tone, I think that they carry a lot of similarities. There's a love of movies there, and there's also a light ribbing of movies there. And you know, like what Joe Dante was saying, was just like he's been accused of making the movie as well as its own Mad Magazine parody, you know, like that's like simultaneously, where it's just like you can have that that affection and also satirize it. But I definitely see that. And it's also, you know, something Joe Dante doing Trailers from Hell and trying to instill an appreciation of film that came before that I really appreciate.
Yeah, it's sort of a gentleness. I mean, even though there's murder in it, you know, there's a gentleness and a kindness about it. It really is. And it's fun and it's cartoony. And so you don't have to take it so seriously that someone really got murdered. It's almost like a wink to the camera, like, well, it's just an actor in a sense. And I really respond to that. And that aesthetic is, again, not, I personally think the quarantine will get us back to that sort of sensibility because nobody really wants to be genuinely. And it's kind of like Pooka Lives, the movie that I did. Yeah. It's very self-aware. It's very cartoony. Nobody is really super scared with anything. Mm-hmm. You could get startled, but it's a dude in a rabbit suit almost, right?
Yeah.
So we're all just having fun and everyone's quippy and funny. And it has that tone that I love so much that Buffy, like Buffy and a little bit of Supernatural that are of an era and have not been cool for a while. But I think we'll make a comeback because we all just want to have fun with each other.
Well, I like that, did they just kind of, did Alejandro just like call you up and be like, look, this is exactly your style and tone. Like what?
Yeah. You know, like, yeah. No. I mean, well, the reason why I got into the movie was my producing partner, Ryan Koppel, wrote the script. So he was like, I sold a movie and I want you to do it. And I wrote you a part. And I read it and I was like, well, you've known me for 10 years. You clearly wrote the exact part I need. Yeah. So I was like, on. And, you know, actually most of the cast were people we know. We knew that we would put up for roles like Malcolm and Jonah, Gavin, Will Wheaton, Rachel Bloom. Those are all people, you know, I called personally. I was like, hey, either audition or would you be willing to do this for me in the movie for us? And, you know, And Alejandro was so excited. We all had all these dream lists and thank goodness we got this ensemble together. And Alejandro is in a great, he has a very Sam Raimi aesthetic, which is again, kind of like sort of like over the top, tongue in cheek kind of sensibility. And so he, the way that he, you know, cast the characters together and emphasized to us as actors, hey, what's going to really carry this movie is the relationship between you guys. So we would always like make extra efforts to be, you know, not be in our trailers. We're like hanging out and going to drinks afterwards. And I can't say, you know, like it's made such a big difference. Like we're still on a text chain together. We really appreciate each other as people. And that doesn't happen often. And I think that the tone in the script, but also the director, you know, Alejandro's work with us really made a difference in, I think, elevating that relationship between all of us.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's something also coming back to Gremlins, These actors actually had been working together. Zach Galligan was already auditioning a bunch with Phoebe Cates for other roles.
Oh, really? I love her so much. I used to think she was just literally the most beautiful. Like her and Olivia Hussey, you know, they had that sort of otherworldly dark hair, like Snow White aesthetic.
Oh, God. Yeah. I think that she's one of the most underrated actors from that time because she kept getting pigeonholed because she was just so beautiful. She is so beautiful.
But she's very good. And, you know, there's a certain style. I don't know if it's specifically for this, but I think it is there's a different kind of style of acting they have. It's less forced. It's very much more internal in a way and almost less engaging with the audience. And it's more objective in a way. I don't know how to describe it. That chemistry really saw the movie through. In fact, I feel like she was really the anchor of the movie, you know, performance wise. When she was in the bar, I was like, this is amazing. This is my favorite sequence.
That scene is so good. And actually, I think they ended up cutting out more scenes that were in that for the theatrical release. And Joe Dante was kind of sad because there's just so much good stuff there.
That's interesting.
With that in mind, I'm going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll actually talk a little bit about that bar scene, a little bit about Phoebe Cates' process. So we'll be right back.
You wept as we crafted the tragic tale of Jar Jar, a Star Wars story.
Yeah. Dude, like, he forgives Darth Vader. Misa still love you, Annie.
You gasped out loud at the shocking twists of Face Off 2, Faces Wild.
He takes his kid's face.
What?
We're writing an entire screenplay week by week on Storybrick Season 2, Heaven Heist. Hey folks, Freddie Wong here with some exciting news about Storybreak, the Writer's Room podcast where three Hollywood professionals have 1 hour to spin cinematic gold. We're shaking up our format by turning Heaven Heist, one of our favorite ideas we've ever come up with on the show, into a full screenplay.
Heaven Heist is an action comedy about a crew of misfit gangsters robbing the celestial Bank of Heaven. Think of Coco meets Point Break.
Join us as we write this crazy movie scene by scene and get an inside look at the screenwriting process on our podcast Storybreak every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today with Felicia Day over in her studio, far away across
the
city.
I think they're on lunch. They're no more banging. I apologize.
No apologies. I love it because it's just like, you know, it's
real, guys. It's real.
We're going for realism here. We're talking about Gremlins, and I really, really want to talk about Phoebe Cates's really wonderful story about her father dying in this movie.
Oh my God. Oh yes, it was so crazy. When I watched that, I was like, kudos to this woman for carrying this off.
Yeah, because there's like a great story behind that. So her character is like, she doesn't like Christmas. And just like at the end of the movie, she reveals that her dad dressed as Santa Claus and got caught in the chimney and died there. So that's why she doesn't like Christmas. But she said, Joe Dante said, quote, "The tone of the movie is summed up in that speech. She's telling a story that's completely ridiculous. However, if it actually happened to you, it would be horrible. It's like the guy falling on a banana peel. It's funny if you're across the street, but not funny if you break your back. I like the complexity of it. Originally, it wasn't even her character who told that story. It was a guy who owned a McDonald's. At the McDonald's, the gremlins would come in and eat the people, but not the food. When that character in that bit disappeared, I said to Chris, I hate to lose that character in that speech. Let's give it to Phoebe's character, Kate, because she doesn't have much stuff going on except being the heroine, and this gives her a secret. The audience has to find out what it is. She doesn't like Christmas, well, why not? And now we find out why. And that's a better character arc for her, and she did it beautifully. I remember we came back from the screening of Rushes that day, and the editor turned to me and said, that's never going to be in the picture, end quote.
Well, I will tell you, I did a movie, and when I was watching this is what I thought of, and I don't normally think about myself when I'm watching movies, but this one, I had to rewind this monologue because I was like, is this really happening? And I'm like, how is everybody off screen not laughing at the writing? And so I did a movie called Mystery Woman, which was Kelly Martin. You know, it was like a wheel of Hallmark movies.
Yeah.
And she was directing. She's amazing. And so I played a tormented horse grooming psychic who had been killed. You know, like she was. And so there's a whole monologue where I'm relaying this trauma that happened to me. I can't even remember it. It was just about being haunted by ghosts and my psychic abilities tormenting me. It was so badly written. But my cat has just died the day before.
Yeah.
And so I was bereft. And so it was an amazing piece of acting, in my opinion. And I could not wait to share it with my agents for my reel. And they watched it and they were like, you're awesome in this. We cannot put this on a reel. This is the worst writing I've ever heard. And when I saw this Phoebe Cates thing, I was like, this is the equivalent. How is she delivering this with a straight face? I was like, she deserves an Oscar for this.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think that she is, you know, as, you know, Joe Dante clearly believes too, is like, she's kind of this unsung you know, rescuer of this very strange picture. Like, she gets it. She like gives it her all, and she's like completely focused on giving a very genuine speech, even though Joe Dante knows that he's almost parodying that as he's doing it. It's a really, really fine line to walk, but I think it's
so hard. And we were talking about that with Pooka Lives, actually, because it is sort of a farce in a sense. Like, it's a comedy, but no, it's not a parody. It's not like Scream or like, you know, one of the Wayans brothers, you know.
Yeah.
It's not that, but it's this other thing that is not, it's so hard to pull off, and it requires, I think, a purity of soul. You can't be cynical. You can't be, you know, jaded. You can't be a cool dude. You have to have that sort of like, we're having fun aesthetic. And that's, it's just so hard to nail. And it's not commercial in a sense. Although when I think it gets made, people love it. It's just not the cool thing to develop in Hollywood. And for a moment, like, because of Steven Spielberg, really, that tone reached the, in Lucas, you know, like that tone reached the audience and basically drove entertainment. It should have, but yet now we've forgotten that lesson. And I'm hoping that this sort of collective trauma that we've kind of been through sort of has a resurgence in that light, playful, let's be hopeful and together kind of attitude.
Let me do some little gizmo stuff, because I told you at the beginning of the show that there was a lot of last minute changes with Gizmo. So this is Joe Dante speaking. He said, quote, "The original script was more gruesome. At that point in the script, Gizmo turned into Stripe, the bad gremlin. But Steven liked Gizmo so much." Steven liked Gizmo so much that about 3 or 4 weeks before shooting, he decided that Gizmo should not turn into the bad gremlin. Instead, Gizmo should be the hero's friend, and he should stick around for the entire movie. We were flabbergasted. We had no idea how to make this little bucket of bolts appealing and realistic enough to be able to hold the screen for the entire picture. But it was a brilliant idea, which I think makes the picture remembered today, not to turn him into a monster, but to have him carried around in the backpack of the hero, Billy, like in a boy and a dog movie. Isn't that like...
100%. That was so brilliant. Like, that really held the movie together. Because I think if it had just... Because as a kid, I watched it when I was 5 or 6 years old, and I would never have remembered this movie if... most of the movie was bad guys.
Yes.
I remember it because of Gizmo. That and E.T. I don't remember anything about E.T. I haven't seen it in forever, right?
Yeah. Like,
but I remember E.T. and I was concerned about his hand being on fire. I can vividly remember that as a kid. And I remember Gizmo and the way that he, and that's Howie Mandel doing the voice of Gizmo, which is crazy.
So good.
I was like, really?
And apparently he didn't really have to modulate much at all from the baby voice that he was already doing when he was doing acts. So Joe Dante was just like, sure, Howie Mandel, let's do it, you know?
It makes me, how do you get that job?
I know. Like, you just got to practice a baby voice in the mirror, Felicia. Like, you've been going on the wrong career path. Oh my God. And you know, I want to get into the thing that you also brought up, the thing that you loved, which is when Gizmo saves the day. And this is where we'll kind of wrap up, because this also wraps into the privileges of working with Spielberg. Joe Dante said, quote, "One of the great things when you work for Steven Spielberg, aside from him keeping the studio off your back, is that you get to finish your movie completely before you show it to the public. Instead of taking out a beat up work print with a temp score and lots of splices, you presented a finished movie at the preview. We did a little more fine tuning after the preview. That's what a preview is for, after all. We shortened the movie by 6 or 7 minutes. We also beefed up the role of Gizmo, the little fuzzy critter, so that in the final version, at the end of the picture, he saves the day, not the nominal hero, Zach Galligan, who was very miffed when he saw the finished movie because he no longer pulled the shade up and killed the gremlins." End quote.
Wow. He got upstaged by an animation. Oh, wow. He was mad? That's so hilarious.
He apparently, like, he came to be okay with it, but he was just like, what the fuck? I was supposed to be the hero of this movie.
I was supposed to save this movie, and this little dude did. But I was so happy about that because, when I was watching the movie, I'm like, oh, Gizmo's so cute. And then he just rides around in a backpack for like 30 minutes. And I'm like, give Gizmo something to do. And thank God he had that moment at the end, because I was literally – my childhood memory of him was more of a hero. And when he drove that little car, I was like, there you are. There he is for me.
You know, it's so weird because, like, the two characters who, you know, I came to love and that became really iconic to me, and not that I don't love Billy and Zach Galligan's performance of, you know, what he's bringing to that, but, you know, Phoebe Cates and Gizmo, these two characters, ended up getting their story arcs after the fact. You know, like Phoebe Cates' character.
It's so interesting that they didn't go in. And, but, you know, that makes it more interesting. That makes it a little more interesting, to be honest with you, because it's more, it's not just a dude's journey. Like, it has sort of that ensemble feel. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Phoebe Cates emotionally, you know, as an actor, you connect with her more than Zach. And then Gizmo saving the day makes you, it's just so crazy and so much better than a human saving it. If you're going to go in this crazy world with all these crazy animatronic creatures, like, don't just sideline them all and give it to a dude.
Yeah.
I love it.
They may not have known it when they were going in the original script, right? Like, look, you know, like, it's a bunch of guys. They're making a movie. Like, they might not get it, right? They might assume it's just like, okay, it's just going to be the usual male hero. But they figured it out along the way. And that's something that I appreciate.
It makes you, it actually makes me believe in last minute rewrites a little bit more, because you have to be flexible. I guess filmmaking, you know, being rigid is to your detriment, because, you know, the collaborative nature of it, the ability to kind of follow, you know, your impulses. And I think that's something in web video that I loved, because we would just pick up a camera when we had a funny idea and mm-hmm. we just shoot it, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's that sort of spontaneity that I think you can't have. You know, I just finished developing a TV show that I was producing, and it's probably not going forward, but it's 18 months just of working out beat to beat, going mm-hmm. back and forth all the time on something. And I'm just like, I don't even know where the fun, why did we start? Where did we start? What was the fun, you know?
Yeah.
I've forgotten it because we have taken so long. Like, that creative spark is what I believe the internet does so well. And that's like what fuels me, that sort of like, oh my God, mm-hmm. I have a great idea. Let's be on top of it and just share that impulse. Mm-hmm. It's more of an emotional kind of thing, which kind of gets, it really, it's hard to get that in the process of development.
Yeah.
Obviously Spielberg was able to do that because he could just be let go.
I think, you know, that's the thing. Like, I don't think you can overrate Spielberg, because, you know, if he's bringing that kind of creativity as a boss, like, I guess what you want in these long development processes is just a good boss. Someone who's there to like help you remind you why you're doing it. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your career and all things Gremlins. And so people can be seeing Pooka Lives on Hulu soon, correct?
It's on Hulu right now. You can watch it. It is. It was out April 7th. So go ahead and watch it. It's really, really fun. And I've got other things I'm working on writing-wise. And I didn't mean to make it sound like I'm quitting Hollywood. I always do that. But the thing is, the last 3 weeks has just made me realize, believe in yourself, believe in what you want to do. And if they don't, if it's not sold, you could do it other ways. It's not you. I guess it's not you, it's them. And as a creator, it's hard to sort of do that, like get back to your roots and be like, okay, what I want to say mm-hmm. is fun. These stories I want to tell are great. And if they don't want them, it's not personal. It's just not right for them.
Yeah, which is exactly Joe Dante's thing.
Exactly. You get a little refresh and you get back in there and like, hey, man, you got to love this because it's really wonderful. I believe in it. So anyway, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. And everyone check out Pooka Lives. And you can also just find Felicia on the internet with her many, many, many projects, because she is so extremely busy. So check her out.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. We're going to start doing a little something different, as you may have noticed from our last episode. From now on, I'm going to be giving you a staff pick, a recommendation of a film directed by a woman. And I know people have a little bit of time on their hands and can't really go out at night. So I wanted to recommend some movies for you guys to watch as you're winding down and getting ready for bed. And this show is all about highlighting the great work of female filmmakers after all. So, you know, let's give a recommendation. Today's recommendation is a little something fun that hopefully matches up well with Gremlins. It's Jackie Kong's Blood Diner, a very hilarious horror comedy that is over the top and wonderful, and has that wonderful 1980s aesthetic too. You know, it doesn't really care about realism, and you know what? Fuck realism. So if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.